What happens to our society when we can't replace ourselves? We have all of these different ideas of future abundance, but it's all based on this idea that the current world's going to continue as it is. And what I've been seeing through lived experience and through research is that it's not. If it were not for us essentially strip mining professionals from Africa and South Asia, the Canadian healthcare system would have ceased to function about 10 years ago. And the problem is even they are going to run out because childlessness is becoming a thing in India, just like it is in Europe. What it's selecting for, in my opinion, is people that are capable of forming a high trust micro society, capable of resisting all of the maladaptive traits that modern culture has presented us with. If you look at the fall of Rome, it's that same idea, parallel polities. Out of decaying Rome came this feudal society, which grew organically out of the decline of the central power.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Professor Alan Varjuk, who is Professor of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. And he has written an extremely interesting book called Grey Apocalypse. And I found it especially fascinating. If you chaps know about my own research, I look at all of these different things and how they're going to cause the collapse of civilization to do with genetics and this sort of thing. And what he's arguing, essentially, is that even without there being these genetic factors in who's having children and who is not having children, the very fact that people are not having enough children will lead to that collapse. And not only will it lead to that collapse, but it will. He speculates intelligently on some quite fascinating and Orwellian forms of totalitarianism that it might lead to as well. And so that's what I want to look at today. So, Alan, hello.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on.
So this book, then, Grey Apocalypse, what inspired you to put quill to vellum and to write it?
Well, it's actually a really interesting story. My interest in demography, a lot of people say, "Oh, you're a doctor. Why are you so interested in this?" It actually stems from my education. Back in grade 11, we had a very brief one-day unit on population pyramids in our social studies and histories class, and this sparked what's been a lifelong interest in that area. And ultimately, what I've been grappling with is how to provide my sons with the best possible fatherly advice for their future. And, I look at what type of a failure the baby boomers were in preparing my generation for the future. I thought, you know what, I've got to do a deep dive on this. And what's really interesting is the deeper that I went into, okay, well, where is the world going? What is the best advice to give my children? The rabbit hole just kept getting deeper. And at the end of the day, it demanded to be presented as a serious book. As a physician, I've had a front seat to watch, I think, the first really good example of the decay of a major social institution, which is the Canadian healthcare system, and how that fits in, and then to watch it start to affect other parts of our governance. It's what inspired the idea of the geriatric state, and ultimately, we're in the situation where we have to ask this question: what happens to our society when we can't replace ourselves? And we have all of these different ideas of future abundance, but it's all based on this idea that the current world's going to continue as it is. And what I've been seeing through lived experience and through research is that it's not. The craziest thing about it is that when you travel the world, you don't see the type of children of men scenario that you'd expect, right? South Korea is probably the clearest example. Its fertility rate has fallen to levels that would be considered ridiculous a generation ago. The lights are still on, the trains are still running on time, and the country itself is wealthy. And that's what makes this whole phenomenon so fascinating and dangerous. It's not like a heart attack where all of a sudden, boom, society is in a very difficult state. It's more like Alzheimer's disease. It's slow, it's relentlessly progressive, and it's terminal. And the problem is because it's so slow. And because it's so comfortable, it doesn't create the type of crisis that would spur governments into action. And that is one of the main reasons
presumably, though, to follow your metaphor on Alzheimer's, it is slow, but there are certain turning points. There are certain things when you realize, hang on a minute, she can't drive a car.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute, she's got lost, and we have to go and find her. Hang on a minute, she's forgotten who I am. So are there likely to be clear turning points of that kind?
Yeah, and I would actually argue strongly that we're already seeing those turning points, not just in Canada, but in the United States and Europe and in East Asia. I'll give you some examples from our healthcare system right now. If it were not for us essentially strip mining professionals from Africa and South Asia, the Canadian healthcare system would have ceased to function about 10 years ago. We're in a situation where we're not producing enough credentialed youth in Canada to make this essential component of our society function. And it's starting to break down. In this province, we have mid-sized cities, 100,000 people in the city, and the emergency department, it's closed for entire weekends because they can't staff it. And we had another one of our major cities, Calgary, in the last 5 years, because of an inability to keep the right people on staff and train the right people, they've had twice now their major water mains break to the point where a quarter of the city was having to boil its water. You're seeing this breakdown process. The other major warning sign that we're seeing in Europe and in North America is the development of a situation where you have a political bloc which is entirely interested in preserving its own entitlements and its own comfort level, right? I'm not sure if you're familiar with the most recent Canadian election held last year, but it's the first really solid example in our country of what we call the geriatric state or geriatric democracy. The Liberal Party, of course, is well known for its entitlements in this country. It's the party that created the Medicare system, the pension system, all of these things. And essentially, they've got this credibility that they're going to maintain and expand those systems. They won the election, and they won the election purely because they received overwhelming support in the baby boomer and retired person demographic. It's very fascinating. Canada, and you look at our political polling even today, Canada is fracturing into a situation where you have one group of people who's aged and entitled voting one way, and the young people who are desperate, most young people in Canada, just like in the United States, can't afford a house, voting a different way. And the problem is that this last year, they demonstrated a working electoral majority. And unfortunately, when you look at the demographic trends in Canada, there is very little hope that that is going to change.
Explain to me, presumably, civilization, as I sort of see it, or industrialization, involves the extent to which we develop must outpace population growth.
Yes.
It's an important thing, right? It's a bit like building up capital. The extent we must develop in terms of making things simpler and more efficient and whatever, more quickly than population growth. And as long as we do that, standards of living will go up. And if I go back 25 years, when I was a young man in my 20s, one of the things that we noticed was things were getting cheaper. Food had been getting cheaper for a long time. Flights. Suddenly you got Ryanair and EasyJet and all this, and you could go and fly from London to Dublin for £20. Whereas it used to cost a couple of hundred. Things were getting better. That's how it seemed, and people were happy. And now we notice food is getting much more expensive. It's probably gone up by about 50% since COVID. I don't know, I'm guessing, but something that's got a lot more expensive. Housing is more expensive. How does the aging population interfere with that process whereby population growth has to outpace development? What's it going to do in everyday terms of everyday life?
Well, it's really interesting because it's so multi-layered, right? That the first thing that an aging population does that you're going to notice and that we are noticing is the pace of innovation slows. Most inventions, most new business ideas, most radical political ideas or even philosophical ideas, come from young people. You look historically, it's people under age 40 that come up with the major innovations that drive society forwards. And why did they do that? Well, because there's intense competition. In an aging population, the instinct of the entire population moves towards preservation instead of advancement. Now, on the flip side, you don't need as much resources for a senescent aging population as you do for a younger population. Old people just simply don't need to consume like younger people do. But that in and of itself very seriously harms the incentives to innovate and to essentially be dynamic. And so you've got this process happening where people say, oh yeah, well, we're going to go ahead and we're going to see as the population shrinks, we're going to replace that with robots and with artificial intelligence. And we're going to see essentially our standard of living remain stable. I don't think that's the case. And I think a big piece of this is that the capital, and I love the fact that you brought that up, the capital necessary to automate an entire society is immense. And the problem is that outside of Northeast Asia, we are massively allocating our capital in the wrong direction, right? Because we have these electoral majorities developing, or in the case of places like Canada, developed, where seniors hold unassailable political power, capital is being directed to ensure that their entitlements continue, to ensure that they live in the comfortable high level of standard of living that they're used to. And that capital, which is being used to keep them comfortable in the form of pensions, healthcare, et cetera, is unavailable to be invested in automation and artificial intelligence. And so the problem is that as people age out of their jobs, we're not going to be able to make the next generation productive enough in order to actually maintain that degree of productivity. So I actually think it's going to be a little bit of a surprise for people like Elon Musk that are predicting this future world of abundance. I'd love it if it were true. But what I see us doing is investing enormous amounts of money, both publicly and privately, in keeping seniors comfortable. And that capital is just simply not available to make workers more efficient, which we have to do if our pool of workers is shrinking. So I actually think that what we're going to see, at least for the next few decades, is essentially something along the lines of Japan's lost decade, where things become progressively grimier, things become progressively in disrepair and shabby. But we kind of muddle along. The problem is that we have to maintain a lot of this essential infrastructure, and it has a best before date. And when that starts happening, if we can't keep up, we're going to run into a real world of hurt later this century.
It's essentially saying that, I mean, as you may know, I've researched intelligence, and intelligence is also in decline, which is relevant to this as well. But even if intelligence were not in decline, even if that was held stable, you have certain personality traits, as it were, that personality changes with age. We know that beyond our 20s, we become more conscientious, we become more agreeable, we become less neurotic. And it is those three traits that are positively associated with innovation, as far as I can work out. And also testosterone goes down, and that seems to be associated with drive and innovation. So you've got fewer and fewer people like that. So in a sense, there's fewer people that are able to solve the problems that will come along as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the incentives aren't there, right? The incentives are misaligned. And on top of that, if you're going to be spending your life working very hard to accomplish something, compare our current situation to what the baby boomers and Generation X folks that developed the modern technology world grew up in the 1970s and 80s. The taxes that they paid were way lower than the taxes that we pay. The regulations that they faced when they started their businesses were far less than what we have now. And I don't see any chance that, again, looking at those personality traits, you look at them on an individual basis. I'm looking at them on a national civilizational basis, right? Because the civilization takes on those traits. I don't see any world in which what you might call the Karenization of our nations is going to decrease regulation.
I like that. Women are higher in those traits. It is to do with a female influence as well, I suspect.
You should watch this video with full awareness of the rhetorical techniques being used. The best way to do so is by adding the parallax extension to your Chrome browser. In 10 seconds, you'll see the tricks people use to try and sway you.
Whatever is you speak engine that you don't like, you'll point to things like crimes, but I mean, like, crimes are illegal. Obviously, they shouldn't be happening.
As you scan, you'll build framing scores for authors and creators and for yourself, and you'll see what techniques you're frequently exposed to. You can also ask Parallax anything you want, including the strongest version of a particular argument. Download Parallax by clicking the link in the description.
But even something quite quotidian, like what all these repeats that we have now at the cinema, whereas mm-hmm. or remakes or reboots or prequels or all that is what a low risk kind of mind will do. Whereas if you go back to the 70s, and as the society was much more youthful, yeah. and the average man would die at about 70,
yeah.
Then of course you can see that there's more of an inclination to take risks, try new things, experiment, because the whole culture would be more youthful.
Well, and it's what's really interesting, and I mean, you're probably roughly my age. We've seen it happen. We've watched the dynamism of our society in Canada and the United Kingdom and in all similar societies. We've watched it drop. It's visible. We've seen it happen. The last time I was in the UK, I was actually blown away with how, you know, I hate to use this, with how shabby it's gotten. I couldn't believe how compared to, say, even 2012, right? I've been to the UK quite a few times over the last 20 years, just that the progression, you know, and I'm sure that people coming to Vancouver are seeing exactly the same thing. You know, Vancouver 20 years ago was unquestionably, like 15 years ago, time of the Olympics, was unquestionably one of the greatest cities in the world. But it's absolutely full of people that are defecating in the streets and living under park benches, even in the wealthy areas now. And we can't police it. Maybe we're not even willing to police it.
So what would be the connection between the society being older and it being shabbier? Wouldn't an older society be more
it's
order?
Yeah. So part of it is that we're not we're no longer going after. So you think about it like a military, right? Like having order and having you know, everything in its proper place, right? So actually, you know what? I would connect it up with something in medicine, right? So you look at somebody who's doing well mentally, right? They're not going into a state of dementia, right? You go into their house, you do a house call. What are you going to find? You're going to find a well-ordered house. Most likely it's clean. Everything is in its place, right? Now you get somebody who's in cognitive decline and you go into their house. What are you going to find? Well, you're going to find potentially a cat lady, right? You're going to find layers of newspaper. You're going to find a mess. You may find numerous animals that aren't cared for. It's almost as though our society is becoming a gigantic house of a cat lady. On top of that, we have this, you know, to your point about, you know, feminization of our nation states that's happening. And I think that's part and parcel with the aging process, is this unwillingness to punish people that are not following the law. And it seems as though the Gad Saad wrote this, the recent book there, Suicidal Empathy, right? This tendency towards making excuses for things when they go wrong rather than setting them right.
No, fair enough. I'm not understanding what is the two things that are interesting that I would like to expand on. Why, other than that, you know, if you've read John Glubb's The Fate of Empires, feminism always seems to happen at the end of empires, but you're connecting it to being old. I wonder what the cause of being an old society in the sense of lots and lots of old people. And I wonder what the connection is there. And secondly, what would be the connection between a general spirit of oldness caused by lots of people being old and things not being fixed and things being left shabby?
Well, I mean, again, on the second point, things being left shabby, it's a matter of people are just they're no longer putting in the effort to look after the public good. They're looking after their own situation, right? On the first point, so
well, I just think, hang on, actually, yeah. I suppose you could argue that in order to keep things not shabby, you have to be sometimes a bit violent and aggressive.
Absolutely.
That's gone.
That's gone. We aren't willing to stand up for keeping our societies in a place where we're even able to create the conditions from which order can spring. It's a fascinating thing to watch. I mean, we've watched it through our progressing from when I was a youth in the 80s through to today. It's really been something else to see this unfold. And the problem, part of the problem for us younger people is that people are saying, well, you know, do I really want to bring children into this mess, right? And you know, I say to them, well, you know what, this mess that we see today, yeah, you know, it's a lot worse than it was in the 1990s, but compare that with what our grandparents and great-grandparents were dealing with, right? While we were on the upswing, the world was a lot worse in the 1930s and the 1800s than it is today. And people still had children. People still had tremendous hope for the future. But it seems like people have lost that. Like the spark's gone.
Yes. And the second point was the feminization thing. Why is it that...
So again, the points that you were making earlier about personality traits of elderly people overlapping with that of the more feminine personality traits is where I think that comes from. Those aggressive go out there and change the world types of traits that the young people have, they are more masculine traits, right? And an aging world, it promotes that more, and I say the word conservative in the sense of not going out, doing anything radical, doing anything unusual. It promotes more of that, that stasis, right? That stability. And I think that's part of why, as you get more seniors, you get more of that that stasis, that lack of risk taking, and as things are in a state of decline, I mean, you need to have people that are going to go out there and say, no, we've got to make this major change here. We're going to go and push to do this, but politically, those people cannot get elected because the majority of the electorate is saying, no, I just, you know, just keep everything going as it is until I make my exit from this world.
That's very interesting because it's the spirit of being old in most people is, as you say, a spirit of gardening and crown bowling and just sort of enjoying your time in God's waiting room,
watching television
and not really doing very much. And that's the impression that I get over the last 20 years. We've gone from a society that does things to a society that doesn't really do very much anymore. Really do much, nothing new, no great drama, no great art, no great anything anymore.
It's really I mean, we saw this in Rome, right? If you go down to Italy and you tour the various and Greece and you tour the various grand historical monuments, you look at the art that they made during the dynamic periods of their civilization versus the art that they produced or lack thereof in the final century, right? And there's so many parallels there. I mean, it's a different reason why, well, there's a lot of overlap, I suppose, but there's a different core reason why they fell versus why we're in this state. But I think that you can learn a lot by looking at the art of a culture. The same thing that we see in Egypt, right? You look at the two big periods of decline, the end of the Old Kingdom and then the end of the New Kingdom in Egypt. And we see the same thing. There's less magnificent architecture. There's less art. There's less, everything starts seizing up. And I think that we're seeing a similar dynamic here. The difference is the underlying trigger is this lack of having adequate numbers of children.
Well, the argument then is that we bring in people from the third world and that they'll have more kids. But as I understand it, they tend to adopt our levels of fertility after a few generations.
Absolutely. It's not even after a few generations. It's really the second generation is already more or less adopted to the local mores, right? Immigration is a really interesting, it's probably the most important political issue of the century thus far. And it doesn't matter which country, right? I've just decided an election in Japan. The American politics is entirely focused on immigration, and it seems Europe is as well. And the thing that I think is really interesting is that we're getting it wrong, right? In Europe, you often read about this, in Canada as well. Oh yeah, well, immigration has done so well for Canada and the United States. You look at the historical data. You know, you bring in immigrants and wow, look at the innovation that's developing. You know, they built the country. The problem is that it's all on the incentives, right? Canada has done a really good job in the last 40 or 50 years strip mining places like India and Africa of its doctors, its nurses, its engineers, and so forth. But the incentives have changed, right? In the past, Canada, like Europe, was a very high trust society. It had reasonable taxes, reasonable regulations. It was a good place to start a business. There was lots of land available, and things have changed. We now have this suffocating regulation. We have taxes where very quickly you hit a tax bracket where you're paying 55, 56% of your marginal income. And in Europe, you have wealth taxes. And if you're in a place like India and you're saying, okay, well, no, I've got this brilliant new idea, right? I've got this, this new AI product that I'm going to push out. And you're like, okay, well, where can I best start this business, right? You're not going to go to Berlin. You're not going to be able to start your business in Berlin if you look at their regulations. And even if you did, you're going to end up paying half your income in income tax, right? So that you can pay for other people's retired parents. You can make that money just as well in Bangalore as you can anywhere in the world. So why wouldn't you stay there, right? And on the flip side, what's happening is people are looking at the West. And if you're somebody who is on social assistance or whatever passes a social assistance in a place like Egypt or a place like Pakistan, why would you stay there when you can walk into a Western country and receive Western level welfare, right? And so what we're doing is we're no longer attracting the people we need to create dynamism. And instead, what we're doing is we're attracting people that are there to essentially as additional dependents. And the problem is even they are going to run out, because you look at India, the latest numbers for 2026 showing their total fertility rate is now at 1.8. It's trending so that in a few years, their fertility rate is going to be lower than the United States.
Oh, yeah. I was reading that in the richer part of India, so in southern India, places you mentioned, Bangalore, those kinds of places, it's even lower. And it's quite common in some areas to have only one or two children already in some parts of.
Childlessness is becoming a thing in India, just like it is in Europe, and you see this. So my wife and I, we take our family. We make a point of taking our children, and it's a bit of a zoo because we've got four of them, on international trips a couple of times a year, and this is part of, I argue, it's part of their homeschooling. But we travel and we don't go to, you know, sun destination. We're not going to Ibiza. We're going to gritty places like Cairo. We're going to places like Rabat and seeing these places. And I'm talking to these people on the ground. I'm seeing it. You go to a place like Morocco. I don't know if you've been to Morocco recently, but you have all these young people and you have no children, right? They had a huge baby boom in the 80s and 90s. I was talking to one shopkeeper in rural Morocco. We basically toured the whole country. He says, oh, wow, what a nice family you've got. I said, oh, yeah, thank you very much. How many children do you have? And he said, oh, I have five. And so he's an older guy. And I said, so how many grandchildren do you have? And he looks at me, he says, zero. And I said, oh, well, how old are your children? I'm thinking to myself, maybe you had them older, et cetera. 45, 43, 41, 38, 35. And he just shakes his head and he says, they have cats. And this is a guy who had five kids, all of whom are now exiting their reproductive years and has zero grandchildren. And we're seeing this dynamic happen all over the place. The way it spreads is really interesting. It starts in the major cities, and you know, tipping my hat to what you're saying about India, which is very true. And then it spreads to the secondary cities, and then it spreads to the small cities, then the towns, then the rural areas. And there's a pattern to it. And we've seen that pattern occur in Europe. We saw that pattern occur in East Asia. We saw that pattern occur in North America.
In Athens, Rome, and Baghdad.
Yes. And now we're seeing this happen in North Africa. A lot of people don't realize this, but there's no country in all of Latin America with a positive fertility rate. If you watched American politics, which Canadians do all the time, you'd never know it. But most of Latin America now has lower fertility rates than America has. And you look at North Africa, the Arab part of North Africa, they're not having children anymore. And the same pattern is now starting to happen in sub-Saharan Africa, places like Lagos and Nairobi.
It also starts with the higher classes, because one of the things that was noted even by sort of Darwin and Francis Galton and people like this was that the higher classes weren't having children and the lower classes used to have high child mortality and now they didn't. And you got this significant change. And the other thing seems to be wars. You always get a baby boom in the wake of wars,
both World
War I and World War II. And there's studies that have found that if you are exposed to mortality salience, then this seems to elevate your desire to have children and B, your desire to namesake, so to create a kind of symbolic immortality. And that it may be that it's like there's an instinct almost to breed. And our instincts come out if we're exposed to our evolutionary match, which is death, lots of death, 50% child mortality before 1800, 40% child mortality, whatever, depends on the area, but something like that. And we're not exposed to that anymore. And so then it's a selection event for people that have some kind of instinct to have children.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that is that recent data will back that up, right? Where is the countries that have the highest fertility rate in the Northern Hemisphere? Well, Iraq. Well, Iraq has a high fertility rate because, well, they just went through 15 years of war.
Are you ready for the future of the West?
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear the full thing, as well as help with my other projects, then please become a subscriber at jollyheretic.com.